Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Getting It Done with your host here, Dr. Walter Dean. This is it's Black History Month, and although I've been covering a lot of different topics, I decided today to go back to where I originally started, and that was dealing with music for Black History Month, and I wanted to present to you whom I think is probably one of the greatest saxophone players of all time. The sound that you probably will hear will be a little scratchy, but you'll be able to tell the different things about this musician because of his intonations, his presentation, the clarity of this and the sweetness of the sound. So let's give a listen to the great Charlie Parker.
Charlie Parker, what goes through my mind is the epitome of what jazz is supposed to be. We're talking about an unbelievable amount of soul. We're talking about a guy that is able to express himself so purely.
Was born August 29th, 1920, at 852 Freeman in Kansas City, Kansas. It was a two-bedroom apartment above a grocery store. And his grandmother lived up the hill, and his half-brother lived up the hill, and they'd get together and play in front of his house. He called his half-brother Ike. And he lived there until 1927, when his family moved to Kansas City, Missouri.
I had. You know, elementary school band, starting an instrument early. Those things, you know, music was very strong back then, and it's that's part of being in Kansas City, having a strong instrumental program.
Charlie first picked up saxophone when he was in fifth grade, when Kansas City School District instituted the music program in Penn School. And he, his mother bought him a $40 horn in a pawn shop, and Lawrence Keyes described as being ragged as a pet monkey. But he grew up in the heyday of Kansas City jazz. When he was coming up, Benny Moten was really at its peak. The Moten Band was at its peak. Kansas City was a hotbed for jazz because the Pendergast Prosperity, the government fostered vice and corruption. There were clubs stretching from the river that's out south in the county to 75th Street. Mary Lou Williams recalled 50 clubs featuring live music between 12th and 18th Street, and vices of all kinds were available. On 15th Street was the red light district to stretch for blocks from downtown. 12th Street was just a line of clubs. Dave Dexter estimated there was as many as 20 clubs in a single block. There were also gambling in the front windows and any kind of vice you wanted. Marijuana was readily available, as was narcotics. And so musicians from the Southwestern Territories came to Kansas City where they could find work.
It's inconceivable to imagine a Charlie Parker being born in Oklahoma or Philly or any place else and being able to nurture his art on that level. And not that there wasn't great jazz going on in Philly or a lot of other places, but here in Kansas City at that time, when you have all these, this row of clubs, and they're going all night long, 7 days a week.
And he began playing as a teenager when he was 15 years old. His first group was called 10 Chords of Rhythm, later the 12 Chords of Rhythm, a group led by Lawrence Keyes that played right across the street, 18th combined, in the Lincoln Building, at Lincoln Hall. And it was a kid band. They were non-union, but they made more money than union members because they played for the door. And it was a very popular hall for Lincoln High School students. And so it would pack the place. And that's really where he got to start professionally. Thank you.
I've been listening to Charlie Parker since I was, well, ever since I can remember. He was a friend of my father and my mother's. He used to drive us down through all the areas where the Cherry Blossom and where the Reno Club and the Hey Hey Club. He used to tell us about these places. His favorite roost was balcony above the Reno Club bandstand. There were marijuana smoke from the Basie band smoking reefers on the bandstand that walked upstairs. This was their heyday. They tell us about the all-night jam sessions in the Reno Club where you could buy reefer and you know, and stuff. But that's part of the menu. He came from an era that was very unforgiving, too. And I know that just from listening to my father and his friends talk about me. So, I mean, I didn't get a free pass with my dad and his friends when I was learning how to play. Either you're saying something or you're not. And I'm sure Charlie Parker's era, because these were the guys of his era that were molding my way of thinking.
In spring of 1936, he sat in on a jam session at the Reno Club where the Basie band was playing. And he faltered while soloing on Honeysuckle Rose, forgot the changes, and Joe Jones threw a cymbal at his feet.
You know, everybody wants to talk about when Charlie Parker got gonged by Joe Jones, but the part that you don't realize is he was back the next night or the week later. And he was done that in this particular, I can't hear this no longer. But it don't mean that he can't come back. It just means, okay, we've had enough tonight, Bird, gotta go.
He was publicly humiliated, but also inspired him to go to the woodshed, as musicians would say, to practice his horn. So he went to, retreated to Addie's house, and he played his horn sometimes 12 to 14 hours a day. And he said he would never get caught short again. So Joe Jones actually did him a big favor by humiliating him publicly.
Another thing that's been a major factor in their playing is this fantastic technique that nobody's quite equaled. And I was wondering about that, too, whether there was where that came behind practicing, whether that was just from playing, whether it developed gradually. Well, I don't think because I can see really anything fantastic about it at all. I put quite a bit of study into it all, and that's true.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the way that they asked my mother to meet was when they asked me, they said I was driving crazy. You know, and I used to put it with me for 11 to 15 hours a day.
Yeah, that's what I wanted.
That's true, yeah.
If you listen to the precision, the specific nature of everything, the dexterity, like, you can't do that without thousands of hours of practice in a particular isolated space and thousands of hours of actual application in public or whatever type of, like, communal spaces with other people. That's the only way you get to that level. It's not natural talent only serves you so far. Hard work is the thing that really is, like, the germinating factor for I think, you know, the seed that you're planting in the ground.
Study is absolutely necessary in all forms. It's just like any talent that's born with it tonight, it's just like a good pair of shoes and a pretty shine on it, you know? Like school brings out the polish, you know, as any talent is happens anywhere in the world. Einstein had school. But the only definitely changes, you know, it's
everybody knew Charlie Park would be down in the park. Back then they used to call it Paseo Park. Now they call it Parade Park. Back in Paseo Park, he'd be flexing his horn in the afternoon, just in the horn, in the park flexing. Him and my dad were real good friends. He used to call my father Sir James. He used to go swing by the park and pick up birds, and Charlie Park would be in the wilderness, so he used to keep practicing. And so he'd be riding through the neighborhood in his convertible with my mom and Charlie Parker playing. Well, I'm in my mind, I'm like, oh my God. That was just an example of how you always knew what Charlie Parker was doing. He was always playing. So at the park practicing all day, playing, sitting in the park all day playing, and then at night he, you know, was basically them struck up or Jay McShane or anybody that's got the hidden bands, he goes from place to place, sitting in with everybody all night long. And so he lived it. And he's a perfect example of an artist living it. I mean, and he said that. He said, if you don't live it, it won't come out your horn.
There's a number of watershed incidents in Charlie's life. He was on his way to a gig at Messer's Ozark Tavern, which was 5 miles south of Elgin, Missouri. And the car flipped over and threw him out of the car and killed George Wilkerson, the leader, and threw his buddy Ernie Daniel 60 feet into a plowed field, and it broke Charlie's ribs and it broke his back. And it destroyed his horn, so Mr. Messer brought him a new Selmer, which gave him a lift. But it also gave him a habit because they prescribed heroin for his pain, and he developed a taste of heroin, and he struggled with that the rest of his life.
And I feel like that other side is like what people target a lot when they speak about Charlie Parker. All I know is that what was left for me to examine is this wonderful, like, body of work. Genre-wise, whatever I could ever sound like, it's only important that everyone knows it would not exist if it was not for Charlie Parker.
Thank you.
buddy led.
Ultimately, all of this plumbing and metal and stuff is supposed to be an extension of you. The ultimate goal is to express yourself, whether you're doing it with a trumpet or a saxophone or a piano. It had, in their time, it had no value to be able to say, I sound just like Duke Ellington, or this guy here sounds just like Lester Young, or he's just like Pops. That has really no value in the big picture of what jazz is about, or any art. I wanna hear you. I wanna get to know you. So if you can paint just like Picasso, at best, you can only become a second best Picasso.
Racism. You know, the unconscious racism To call somebody a racist, I think that's more extreme. That has a definition. But racism shows itself in many ways without white people ever knowing.
I grew up here. Why didn't I learn about Charlie Parker growing up?
Okay. Let's have some real conversation. I grew up in Kansas City. Had it not been for my father, I wouldn't even know about the history of Kansas City jazz. One of the greatest jam sessions that ever took place in the history of jazz took place right here in Kansas City on around 18th and Vine Street area between Coleman Hawkins and Lester Young. All of that was erased. I think that the people that are influential in deciding the image that they want Kansas City to have wanted to erase that whole Pendergast era, the whole 18th and Vine Street, people going partying all night and jazz going on. I think, you know, they want to be known as the city of fountains and they want to have a statue of Winston Churchill on the Country Club Plaza. Now, I got nothing against fountains or Winston Churchill, but the bottom line is that who has more to do with our authentic history, Charlie Parker, Winston Churchill? What image do people think of worldwide when they think of Kansas City? Do they think of jazz or do they think of the fountains? Again, it's hard to not be somewhat blunt. I think because a lot of it is black history, because of black music, man. That's it. You know, it's that simple. We're influenced by what we see and what we hear. I wish I could think of another reason. You know, I don't have to get angry. I don't need a soapbox. You know, I don't need a podium. But that's not what I'm about. You know, when people come to the gig, they want to hear music. But you still have an obligation to make them think, to make them reminisce, to make them dream, to make them forget. That's our job, you know, that's our calling. And that's what I heard from Bird, you know, and as you circle back, that's all in Bird, what I'm talking about, you know. The jazz musicians and Charlie Parker and them, that's why when they got on the stage and they played, that was a beacon of hope and light, you know. And you can see all that, their pain and their struggles and their triumph over adversity. That's what that was. When they asked me about Bird, I hear triumph over adversity, you know? And it was in all of them, you know? Some people like to step around things. You can't. You got to go through things to get to yourself. Because no one just rises out of the ground, you know? You got to come through something.
Back to Messrs. Ozark Tavern, Charlie spent all of that summer practicing. And he began experimenting with the changes in different harmonic approach that would lead to bebop. He learned all the chords and all the inversions when he was down there. He mastered his horn and returned to Kansas City, just a musically changed man. Thank you.
Fellas, you know, and you know, he got, even though he got that nickname, right? That tells you who he was as a country boy.
In 1930, there was a stage production at Penn School, and Charlie and the other kids were out playing in the yard, the other boys were out playing in the yard, and the band director, music director, said, "Hey, you little Yardbirds, talking about chickens, get in there." And Charlie and the little chickens got the kick out of it, so he began referring to chickens as Yardbirds. And in the fall, I think it was in 1940, the Buchanan Band was on its way to play the Big Red up in Lincoln, Nebraska. And they were traveling caravan style in cars, and the car Charlie was riding in ran over a chicken. And he begged the driver to come back, to go back and retrieve the bird.
You're riding in the car, you hit a chicken, you say, "Hey, whoa, whoa, stop. I want that. One man's roll kills another man's meal." I mean, you know, they hit a chicken. He decided we're going to pick it up, and when they get to it, they got the lady to cook it for. That was why they started calling him Yard Bird, which eventually got to be Bird.
For dancers. Duke and Count Basie, a lot of their gigs, in fact, all their gigs probably were dance gigs. And so that means people were listening with their bodies. And I think the difference between that era and the bebop cats, they wanted people to listen with their ears, not just feel the music, but hear the music.
I think that's why so many intellectuals and beatniks, hip cats were all attracted to it, and artists, because it was an original expression of music. And you, it forced you to listen. You know, the whole thing about chasing the bird, you know. If you heard bird, he would get your attention, and you would immediately focus on him because of what he was coming out this morning.
Monk was a big magnet. for these young people. He provided validation, cover, and opportunities and freedom for these young folks to play. And they formed a community. And they shared their ideas. Miles went there from St. Louis. A lot of people came from other places to go to New York.
Essence of Charlie Parker is stripping away the myths that have been wrapped around him over the years.
You know, it sounds more like, you know, like Monotopper, Frick in the Forest, like a little bit. They talk about how he always kept Stravinsky's Firebird suite in his back pocket.
The house was almost full. As Charlie Parker Quintet walked into the bandstand, the trumpeter, Red Rodney, recognized Stravinsky. So he whispered over to Bird, "Hey, Stravinsky's sitting there." Charlie Parker immediately called, and it was customary that he would do this. Coco, it's built on the car changes of Cherokee. Back then, that was one of the that's still like a rite of passage song. Said he played it over 300 beats per minute. So he's a... I can't even hardly hum it. Okay, in the middle of this fast song, Charlie Parker jumps into his solo and is going at this breakneck speed. And then at the beginning of his second course, he inserted the opening of Stravinsky's Firebird Suite. How do you do that? How do you think so fast? Stravinsky's in the audience. Immediately, Stravinsky started pounding the table and said, and the people that were there, they said that he's knocked his glass, his drink all over the people sitting next to him. People were like, you know, but he was so blown away. He went to hear this jazz musician that he'd been hearing about. And now, to hear him live sitting up there, he's sitting out here, and now all of a sudden at this breakneck speed in the middle of his improvisation, he plays one of his compositions, spontaneous. I don't even know anybody that can do that kind of stuff. And I've been playing my whole life, and I'm over 30. So it's like, I can do some things, and I know a lot of real good musicians. I hear the great musicians of our time, and I don't have to name people. We know who they are. But, and I've been in jam sessions with some of them. But I don't know very many. That's hedging a bit. I don't know any that could do that. That I can honestly say, I bet so-and-so could do that. And he did this. This is just one story. There are many stories that Dizzy Gillespie has told, Red Rodney has told, Lewis Hayes, Art Blakey. All of his peers have told different things that he did in the middle of a solo in the night that made all of them say, "What?" Thank you.
had an addictive personality, and it did him in. He threw very high for a very short period of time. And so his third wife, Doris, and his mother, Addie, brought him back to Kansas City after the memorial service in Harlem. And he was buried here in Lincoln Cemetery. According to family members, Addie buried him under a tree so he'd always be in the shade and be hot during the summer. But she wanted to be buried next to him, too. I mean, she loved Charlie. She doted on Charlie. And Charlie loved his mother. He called her every Sunday, regardless of where he was. And so in one way, it was right that he came back here.
But here in Kansas City, you go out to his grave, you can't find it. There's no proper marker at that cemetery. I've been out several times. There's a tenor saxophone engraved on his grave instead of an alto saxophone. There's no headstone. You know, if you go to Père Lachaise, the famous cemetery in Paris, go and look at Chopin's gravesite. It's like a whole, it's not even a memorial. It's like literally like a small church itself. You know what I mean? Like, it's just the tiny, but so majestic. And I feel like we don't take advantage of these things in which we could, you know, we could be better.
Subsequent generations of musicians, he influenced writers, he influenced painters, poets, dancers, he influenced all art.
There would be no Jimi Hendrix without Charlie Parker. There's no Donnie Hathaway with Charlie Parker. There's no Basquiat without Charlie Parker. It doesn't exist. It's cool. Like, no one would even debate that. It's hard to get people to really understand this base, because I think that once you're in that deep, you realize that there's no isolating him without looking at the broad level in which he reached. You know, he's easily the biggest icon from Kansas City. I mean, when I started traveling, going to Japan and Europe, when I mentioned I'm from Kansas City, the first thing said, "Oh, Charlie Parker. Charlie Parker." You know, it's like, it didn't matter what part of the world I'm at. Charlie Parker he has reached a level that we all want to attain as artists.
Hi, my name is Eugene Cantera. I play saxophone. I love the album Charlie Parker Plays Cole Porter so much that I named my son Parker Cole.
I remember as a young teenager listening to Charlie Parker, particularly LP Charlie Parker with Strings, the song April in Paris. I was just hooked. I've listened to that record more than 20 times. Just love.
Hello from Manchester in the United Kingdom. I am Sam Q, a jazz saxophonist for almost 40 years. I first got started playing saxophone when I listened to a record called Scrapple from the Apple from the great, great Charlie Parker, a.k.a. The Bird. His skill and dexterity and substitution of chords was immense. Without Charlie Parker, jazz would not have gone to the modern day era. He's a pioneer and a great figure in jazz music.
The first time I knew something about Charlie Parker When was when I started my career just school. And it was just an experience first time. I was into ladybird. But it was more important that Charlie took me into the right way to make it just solo. Make it just solo is not only to play a random note, it's to speak an instrument, it's to feel.
Mi nombre es Antonio Barachota y vivo en Santiago de Chile. Mi introducción a Charlie Bill Parker fue con el disco Build and Beat y desde entonces he estado 100% enfocado a la escucha de estos músicos. Como muchos amantes de su música, he encontrado profunda intensidad en su registro y en su persona. Build and
Beat. I don't hear any of those bebop guys and I like all of them. None of them sound quite like Charlie Parker. And that's a Kansas City thing. Yeah, I said it. I said it's a Kansas City thing.
This is Getting It Done, and your host, Walter Dean, better known as Dr. Walter Dean, earned doctorate. And you've been listening to the first in a series of Black History Month greats, the great Charlie Parker, who I consider to be probably the greatest alto saxophone player I have ever heard, and Downbeat Metropole also consider him to be that one of the greatest saxophone players, not only of his time, but of all time. If you listened very closely, or you will have heard the clarity, the dexterity, and the speed, and practicing 14 and 15 hours were the reason why he was capable of doing that. When I practiced saxophone, when I was playing it, 2 and 3 hours a day, but never came anywhere near what Charlie Parker was internalizing and expressing in any form or fashion, verbally or through his music. So, as I said, this is Getting It Done, and hopefully the next time you hear me, we will be talking about some other great person who did something in Black history that you won't find in any history book, but you will hear on our show called Getting It Done. Have a nice week.